ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon, Selena Green with you for the next hour. Now, do you rely on palm workers for labour? Well, if so, there are changes coming soon to this popular employment scheme, and we'll take a look at what it means for agriculture. If you do use the scheme, do you have concerns about what these changes will mean for your ability to get workers when you need them? Let me know on my talkback number today, 1300 222 891, or the text line is 0467 922 891. Also coming up, nationally, there is a renewed focus on family violence, but do the measures that the government's been announcing work for farming areas?
We're acutely aware of the disproportionate rates of family violence reporting that occur in rural and regional areas. There is a need for a rural and regional targeted approach that takes account of what we know to be the factors that contribute to those higher rates.
I'll come back to that story in a moment. But first today, workforce shortages are looming again as a major issue for food producers across Australia. That's because there are further changes ahead for the popular Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme. We better know it as PALM. From July 1, employers need to guarantee 30 hours of work a week for those seasonal workers for the duration of their stay. Larissa Smith spoke with Michael Coote and Lucy Gregg from AusVeg about the implications and why farmers have been pulling out of this scheme.
Many of them have travelled. They want to go back home with as much money as possible. They're saying they'd love to work 50 or 60 hours a week, but obviously they can't. It's just too expensive to pay anything over and above the 38 hours.
Michael Coote, are you seeing examples of vegetable growers cutting back on utilising the PALM scheme, even cutting back what they grow?
Very much so. There's examples from around the country with different vegetable growers reporting to us that they are either stopping producing such labour-intensive vegetable product lines to reduce the number of workers that they might need to source through schemes like PALM. Certainly cutting back on the number of PALM workers, given the ever-growing compliance burden and challenges in terms of managing that workforce, and a lot of reporting now to us in our industry that they might be exiting the PALM scheme altogether or are establishing a pathway so that they can now decrease down to a point where they eliminate the need for PALM workers in their business, because it is becoming increasingly challenging just to manage the scheme on a weekly or monthly basis, given the compliance burden that this puts on growers who are just trying to grow and turn out good crops and food to feed Australians.
So if they aren't using workers from these Pacific islands, who are they using?
We've seen quite a trend towards utilising backpackers, certainly now that there's more in the country. We did an industry sentiment survey back in January, and that showed a 20% decline in growers utilising PALM scheme. And then that was reflected in growers adopting more backpackers. So where our concern lies is if they start making changes to the working holiday maker visas and things like that, which certainly been mentioned, and with the migration review currently underway, it's something that we'll be lobbying for to make sure we still have access to the backpackers.
Because if they do remove that caveat where backpackers have to work 80 days in a rural or regional area, that could spell the end of that workforce and be disastrous for food producers right across the country.
Absolutely. You know, if growers do continue to move away from using PALM workers and then need that backpacker labour to supplement their full-time workforce, if we remove the incentive for backpackers and seasonal workers to spend their 88 days working in regional Australia performing roles like picking and packing and harvesting of vegetables and other horticultural produce, where is the labour going to come from that's going to help farmers continue to operate?
We actually had quite a few of our board meet with Minister Conroy's office and Minister Watt's office last month. The one thing is actually having valid data which actually shows, and our sentiment survey is now indicating that people are exiting, and those which are still in the scheme now are saying that they intend to drop palm numbers by 30% by June. So we're getting that data, but we're also collating information of actual real cases of the impracticalities of some of the things that they need.
Such as?
Some of their toolbox meetings and how they, you know, have to actually call the staff in to have them outside of working hours, and then they've actually got to pay them for 3 hours minimum to attend a meet, you know, some of those sorts of things. Palm has been an amazing tool for growers, and many of the growers have utilised it for years and years. They have long-standing relationships with the communities. A lot of them go over to the islands, and I think that was one of the stories that we were trying to tell when we were in Canberra last time, is that these relationships are really special, and the growers really want to maintain the palm scheme, but it does have to be a practical scheme, and unless we can change some of these new deed and guidelines rules, then we will see growers exit.
Setting this minimum weekly rate was designed from the government's point of view to stamp out rogue operators or employers that were doing the wrong thing. Will that achieve that?
I think what the industry really wants to see is a national labour hire licensing scheme implemented across the country that can help to weed out more unscrupulous labour hire contract providers, which will go a long way in helping improve the horticulture industry's reputation around being, you know, ethical employers that do look after their staff, because the vast majority of farmers treat their staff very, very well. They know the importance of having good staff to their businesses to be able to continue to operate viable farming enterprises. And so, you know, ratcheting up the palm scheme rules and guidelines in the deed is only tightening those constraints around farmers' ability to use that as a labour source, but doesn't necessarily address the root cause of issues that have plagued the sector around exploitation or claims of poor workforce treatment.
If there continues to be a decline in the uptake or adoption of palm employers as a workforce, can you expect to see the cost of some of these vegetable lines, fruit lines, going up?
The cost of produce in this country, you know, is driven by a market price. One of the underlying factors that drives that price is the fact that our cost of labour is the second highest in the developed world. We may see certain product lines over the sort of medium term be reduced in terms of the amount of national supply available, which could potentially lead to price increase in certain lines. But what efficient farmers in this country try and do is turn out as much volume as they can to supply all the market channels that they do and to feed this country. Growers will continue to do so. There are a whole range of competing factors that feed into, you know, price, you know, the price point and the cost of doing business and the cost of producing food. And the biggest contributor, you know, to that ultimate end price, is labour, farm input costs, and the economic environment that we're operating in. So we are in an inflationary environment at the moment, and it's likely over the next 12 months that will remain.
Michael Coote and Lucy Gregg there from Odds of Edge, and they were chatting to Larissa Smith about palm scheme changes for seasonal workers. It's 13 minutes past 12. Rural health advocates are calling for tailored government policies to support women fleeing violence in rural and farming communities. Yesterday, the federal government announced it would spend more than $925 million over the next 5 years to provide people with financial assistance to help them flee violent relationships. The upcoming budget will include $5,000 payments to help people escaping abusive situations. However, the CEO of Women's Health Grampians, Marion Hendren, says the policies are too generic and don't take the challenges for rural family violence scenarios into consideration.
I couldn't see anything that was specifically seeming to be targeted at rural and regional communities. From what I can see, the top line item is the package to support women who are leaving unsafe and risky situations. As someone who works in a rural and regional area, we're acutely aware of the disproportionate rates of family violence reporting that occur in rural and regional areas of Victoria and across the country. That would say to me, and I know my colleagues in all these rural areas, that there is a need for a rural and regional targeted approach, that, you know, an approach that takes account of what we know to be the factors that contribute to those higher rates.
And what are some of those factors?
So, look, I mean, take, for instance, the $5,000 leading funding. That assumes that someone has got somewhere safer to go to. You know, $5,000 obviously will help with removal costs, with, you know, changing utilities, with, you know, children's schools, with those sort of functional things. But the key thing, I think, that, say, a woman who is leaving an unsafe situation, who has children, the key thing she will be seeking is somewhere that is safer for her and her children to live. And, you know, what we do see is a shortage of secure, affordable housing in rural and regional areas in particular. So without a focus on making housing a priority as well, I think that the $5,000 isn't going to really make a huge impact for women who leave and want to remain in a regional area, want to keep their kids in school or whatever.
The other thing that is very different in rural and especially farming communities as opposed to larger areas such as cities is the visibility of people in these areas. You quite often are surrounded by many people that you and your potential perpetrator have known potentially for your entire lives. So there's no anonymity in these areas for these women either, is there?
You know, you can be isolated, but yet you can also be... You cannot conceal a lot of aspects of your life coming and going. People will see you, you know, if you're leaving in a vehicle with your children, people will notice that. Relationships can be quite sort of interconnected and entwined. So perpetrators knowing, you know, say police or other service providers that a woman might be wanting to access can be a big deterrent or can actually make things more unsafe. So that lack of privacy and lack of anonymity and lack of place to kind of be under the radar is certainly a big issue.
The other thing that quite often farmers and especially farming families have to deal with is also the fiscal and business consequences as well. If you're a husband and wife team, for example, on the farm, you're also losing your job.
That's exactly right. I mean, a farm is a workplace as well as a home. The knowledge and awareness of the consequences of, you know, a breakup in a farming situation can often be a big deterrent to women deciding, you know, not to take that step because of the implications for, you know, obviously personally, but also for the children and for other family members who may be impacted. It becomes a much more complex scenario to be facing.
If you got to sit down today with the Prime Minister, Maryanne, what would your number one request be to help people in regional areas deal with family violence, especially those on farm?
I would say that investment in remote area design support services would be very, very important. I think funding services to have the ability to, say, support women away from, you know, their local town where they might be seen, and also having, you know, electronic and remote systems and options, not just in regards to the justice system, but in terms of direct supports for women. So thinking very laterally about ways that people can be supported in the context of isolation and rurality.
That was Maryanne Hendren there, CEO of Women's Health Grampian, speaking with Jane McNaughton. Our for confidential information, counselling and support, 1-800-RESPECT is available free. It's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for people impacted by domestic, family or sexual violence. That number, 1-800-RESPECT, is 1-800-737-732, or head to their website. It's 19 minutes past 12. Well, despite a fall in price projections and impacts from inflation, the South Australian dairy industry is optimistic about the future. Chief Executive of the South Australian Dairy Farmers Association, Andrew Curtis, says there's still been strong investment into the sector, and he told Elsie Adamo the state's dairy farmers will need to be strategic to see more growth.
We launched our Dairy Industry Action Plan last week, which certainly indicates our medium to long-term enthusiasm for the industry and its opportunities in South Australia. And we're not looking to step away from that. There are some headwinds, mainly associated with international prices. At the moment, they are quite low in comparison to Australian prices, which will have some impact on what is available to farmers next year. We also have concerns, as the whole of society does, with the impacts of inflation and what that means for our ability to run businesses. But the medium to long term is strong. We've got a really good product and people in Australia and internationally want and in a lot of cases need it.
So how is all that comparing with other time periods you've seen, Andrew? Is this one of the more kind of difficult, volatile times you've seen in dairy?
No, look, there have certainly been more challenging times, and, you know, the time around 2016, 2017 was the most recent of those, where things were far more challenging than they are at the moment. Look, we need to work with our processes to make sure that we all remain viable during, you know, the next year or two. But for all of us, there's pretty positive. Yeah, it looks pretty positive looking forward. Yeah, and that's reflected. You know, we've seen significant investment in on-farm, in infrastructure over the last 2 to 3 years and still continuing. Now, across the state, we have estimated there's well over $100 million that's been spent by dairy farming families in their commitment to the future of the industry and building new dairies, building better systems. We are committing to being in it for the long haul.
And that's, you know, new technology uses as well, things that haven't necessarily been done before, kind of looking forward to the new dairy, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely. Look, and we certainly, you know, the poster technology is the robots, the dairy robots that have been deployed both in the southeast and around the state. But there's lots of other technologies, and then there's, you know, underpasses allowing farms to operate more seamlessly across roads. And then there's a range of other technologies in terms of monitoring cows and cow health, monitoring pastures and impacts on the environment that we've been able to deploy.
And are you happy with the amount of milk being produced in South Australia at the moment? Is it enough to fill demand within the state?
At the moment, it's pretty well balanced, but we see some opportunities for growth, and that growth will come out of the eastern seaboard, but it'll also come through growth in our exports, particularly into premium markets in Southeast Asia. But, you know, we're open to trading with anywhere.
That is SADA Chief Executive Andrew Curtis speaking there to Elsie Adamo.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, speaking of Elsie, she has today's Mount Compass market report. Hi, Elsie.
Good afternoon, Selena. Quality was again extremely mixed as agents offered 705 live weight and open auction cattle. The usual trade and processor buyers were present and active, along with feeders and restockers. Better bred and conditioned cattle in all grades sold to a stronger trend. However, off-type cattle were generally easier, with young light cattle most affected. The majority of the yarding was made up of 104 cows, 232 heifers and 350 steers. Villa steers sold from 160 to 300 cents, with villa heifers ranging from 170 to 285 cents per kilogram. Yearling steers sold from a low of 160 to a top of 320 cents, with heifers ranging from 220 to 295 cents per kilogram. Beef bread manufacturing steers sold from 265 to 303 cents, with dairy breeds selling from 151 to 171 cents per kilogram. Grain steers sold from 164 to 317 cents, with most sales from 240 to 317 cents, while grain heifers range from 185 to 299 cents, with most sales from 250 to 297 cents per kilogram. Light dairy cows sold from 80 to 150 cents, with beef types selling from 145 to 229 cents. Heavy dairy cows range from 170 to 185 cents, with beef types selling from 150 to 283 cents. Bulls sold from 130 to 251 cents per kilogram. This has been Elsie Adamo filling in for John Traeger for the MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Elsie. And now it's time to head to the Weather Bureau. Our forecaster today is Hannah Marsh. Hello, Hannah.
Good afternoon, Selena.
What's going on across the state?
Well, we have seen some isolated thunderstorm activity through the Riverland earlier this morning, but it has continued through the southern parts of the Northeast Pastoral District. And associated with that, we did see up to 9 a.m. 1 millimetre in parts of the Riverland, and since 9 a.m. the falls have generally been less than 1 millimetre. As we head into the afternoon period, we are expecting this shower and thunderstorm activity to continue about the Riverland and parts of the Northeast Pastoral District, as well as possibly extending into the Flinders and Mid-North districts. Having a look at some of the temperatures that it's been up to so far today, it's been up to 19 degrees at Ceduna and Port Lincoln, 18 degrees at Whyalla, 20 at Cooper Pedy, 21 at Oodnadatta, 20 for Woomera, and also at Renmark, 18 so far at Murray Bridge, 19 at Clare, just 12 degrees at Mount Lofty, 16 at Victor Harbour, and 18 for Kingscote and Mount Gambier. As we head into tomorrow, again, we're looking at a dry day for much of the state, apart from those isolated showers about eastern parts of the Northeast Pastoral District, possibly extending into the Riverland, Flinders and Mid-North districts associated with that trough over New South Wales. Temperatures, again, will mainly be near average, and we're looking at the minimum temperatures below average again, so areas of possible frost and fog patches. The winds will be south to southeasterly, and having a look at some of the temperatures for tomorrow, we're looking at 20 for Ceduna and Port Lincoln, 22 at Whyalla, 23 at Cooper Pedy, 25 at Oodnadatta, 23 also at Woomera, 18 with showers at Broken Hill, 23 and partly cloudy at Renmark, 22 at Murray Bridge, 20 for Clare, 20 also at Mount Barker, 19 for Victor Harbour, 20 at Kingscote, and 19 for Mount Gambier. Now, our weather's dominated by this very strong high-pressure system to the south, and that's going to result in the continuation of these slightly above average maximum temperatures and lead to dry conditions over the weekend. So on Saturday and Sunday, we're looking at the maximum temperatures again near average and looking at cold minimums again, so possible frost and fog patches. In terms of cumulative rainfall totals up until the end of Monday, we're generally looking at less than 2 millimetres about the Riverland, Mid-North and Flinders districts, increasing to 2 to 5 millimetres about the southern and eastern parts of the Northeast Pastoral District, with local falls of 5 to 15 millimetres possible, with those heavier showers or thunderstorms mainly near the New South Wales border. And again, that is mainly on Friday and Saturday, Selena.
All right, thanks for that, Hannah. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
That's Hannah Marsh there from the Weather Bureau. Now, looking at the western inland parts of New South Wales, the forecast for Friday for the Upper Western District, cloudy conditions with a high chance of showers, chance of a thunderstorm with some heavy falls possible in the south. East to southeasterly winds, 15 to 25 k's now, becoming light by the late evening. For the Lower Western District, cloudy also with a very high chance of showers in the north, a medium chance elsewhere. There is also a chance of a thunderstorm and some heavy falls possible in the north of that district. Light winds becoming east to southeasterlies, 15 to 25 k's an hour in the morning before becoming light in the evening. Overnight, both districts expecting temperatures around 11 degrees, with daytime temps expected to hit around the high teens into the low 20s. It is coming up to 12:30 here on the Country Hour. In this next half an hour, if you're a farmer, do you feel the love from the wider public? Do you feel like the public trusts you to do what you do and grow what you grow? We'll find out the latest results of a national survey of trust in rural industries and an update on a project that was touted to be the first carbon neutral urea fertiliser production facility in Australia. But things have changed on that front.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green. Selena Green.
Afternoon. And when it comes to farmers, those who work in rural industries, how much do you trust them? How much do you value them? Well, that's a question that's been put to thousands of Australians, and you'll find out what the answer was shortly. Now, the fact is that many primary producers feel underappreciated. They don't feel the love. So will that change? Well, we'll find out shortly, as I said. Also, we've talked a bit about the high price of olive oil at the moment. Well, those of you who love olive oil and olives and those products, well, and many of those who make them as well, it's not great news at the moment.
There was a frost that hit most growers in the state. And because that's the time when the flowers are open, it obviously ruins the flower. I think for Australia, considering that the industry is probably only about 25 years old here, I think this is probably the worst season we've had in Australian olive growing history.
I'll come back to that story shortly as well. This is all after news headlines from Matt Coleman. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, the union representing CSIRO staff says employees have been left feeling angry and betrayed by plans to cut jobs and research under a restructure of the National Science Agency. The CSIRO has confirmed plan changes to the Health and Biosecurity Program would affect about 40 positions, with around 30 being based in Adelaide. Additional jobs across the CSIRO's enterprise services are also at risk, as the organisation looks to reduce costs in these areas by 25%. The state government has introduced new laws that will allow police to destroy hydroponics gear seized from drug busts and to crack down on cannabis growers. Previously, police could only destroy equipment once court proceedings had finished, which meant evidence storage was filled with hydroponic equipment for long periods of time. And the state government has announced a range of safety upgrades for pedestrians and cyclists throughout Adelaide. Under a multi-million dollar investment as part of the nationwide road safety program, data from pedestrian crashes shows that between 2018 and 2022, up to 70% of deaths and serious injuries occurred between intersections. $37 million have been allocated towards footpaths and crossings. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, Matt. Matt Coleman with those headlines. Well, first, a company behind a proposed fertiliser plant in South Australia's outback has withdrawn claims that the project would be carbon neutral. This follows a complaint by the state's Peak Environmental Group. New Riser had previously stated its yet-to-be-built plant at the mothballed Lee Creek coal mine would be Australia's first carbon-neutral producer of urea fertiliser, something in high demand. Well, the Conservation Council of South Australia asked the Australian Securities and Investment Commission, ASIC, to investigate whether the company had misled investors in making such claims. The company has since told the Australian Stock Exchange to disregard all references to the project being net zero or carbon neutral. Well, Craig Wilkins is the former CEO of the Conservation Council of South Australia, and he was at the helm of the agency at the time it initiated the complaint.
There was a big concern with some of the claims being made by New Riser on its website and in its messaging to the stock exchange, and felt that they were definitely misleading their shareholders. And this was of a serious enough nature that the Securities and Investment Commission should investigate. They did, found problems and ordered the company to make amends.
And they have now done that. They have put a clarification on their website. Are you pleased to see that that there has been some accountability here for making claims around carbon neutrality, that it is in fact the case?
Yeah, we are very pleased that this has taken place. It's the minimum that should happen. I mean, ultimately, we think the company should walk away from this proposal altogether because of the nature of what they're proposing is not sustainable. It's not carbon neutral, as they've claimed. And it has huge implications in terms of, you know, for cultural reasons, when you've got the local Andamantna traditional owners who fiercely oppose. That they've always struggled to get across a range of challenges with this project. Definitely the cultural challenge, the fact that it hasn't got the social license. Also, technically, they've really struggled to make the technology work on the site of Lee Creek. But the third and probably the largest challenge has been around the carbon impact. It is a massive carbon bomb, this project, at a time when the state is moving so quickly to smarter and cleaner forms of energy and energy production. So it just seems to be a project which is out of time, it's out of ideas and needs to be put to bed.
How seriously do you take the claims of carbon neutrality? I mean, is this, aside from obviously giving certain information to investors, how serious is this idea of a greenwashing, of claiming that a project is carbon neutral when it is perhaps anything but?
Yeah, I think this is a really serious and emerging problem because it's clear that consumers and end users of products really want to know what the choices they're making are not going to hurt the planet. And when you've got companies making claims that aren't justified, then that really undermines the trust in the system. And we end up not making sound choices, because if products like what NewRiser are claiming to produce are simply not carbon neutral, are making climate change worse, then I can imagine many, many farmers would be very upset about that. They want to make sure that the work they do is of net benefit, and for that they need the right information and some honesty from companies like NewRiser.
We've heard a lot about a need for projects like this for creating fertiliser onshore. I mean, is that something that you would see value in if it is able to be done in an environmentally sustainable, carbon neutral way?
Most definitely. I mean, it does make sense for us to have local production of essential inputs into the agriculture chain, but it needs to be done in a way which doesn't damage the environment. And this is an example of where they just haven't got that right. So we need to explore other options, and that's where the state government's pursuit of green renewable hydrogen offers opportunities. It's still a little way off, but it does offer opportunities. I mean, the reality is even this project is a long way off from being commercially viable. So it's essential that we, you know, stop the fiction that somehow this can be made environmentally friendly, and instead focus on technologies which do have more hope in this space.
It's Craig Wilkins speaking there. He's a former CEO of the Conservation Council of South Australia. Now, in an important notice posted to its website for investors, NewRiser posted these words. It says, all references to or that imply zero carbon or net zero carbon, or that NewRiser or the NRUP will produce carbon neutral urea fertiliser, carbon neutral fertiliser or a carbon neutral product are to be disregarded entirely. The statement says, as of July 1, 2022, NewRiser ceased to be certified by Climate Active as a carbon neutral organisation due to it having not lodged its verified public disclosure statement for the year ended 30th of June 2023 within the time allowed. And as of the 9th of April 2024, NewRiser ceased to be a signatory to the UN Global Compact. Now, I did reach out to both NewRiser and ASIC for comment. I didn't hear back from ASIC, but I did receive a response from NewRiser this morning, which supplied a copy of the quarterly statement it provided to the Stock Exchange on Tuesday. You can read that full document on the company's website. It's 22 minutes to one. Well, just how much do you trust and value the people growing your food and fibre? Well, farmers work hard keeping the country running, but they often feel underappreciated. And the results of a new national survey would hopefully help them feel some love. Researchers from AgriFutures shows that Australian consumers overwhelmingly trust primary producers, and that level of trust is increasingly tied to issues like environmental and water management and animal welfare. Dr. Kieran Moffat joins me. He's the lead researcher for the Community Trust and Rural Industries Project. Dr. Moffat, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Selena.
We're going to delve a bit deeper into some of the ins and outs of this this survey, but I guess overall, how strong is community trust in our rural industries at the moment?
Your community trust over the last 5 years as we've been conducting this research program has remained pretty steady and quite strong. So of all the industries we do this kind of work in, rural industries have the strongest level of community trust and acceptance of its activities.
And I guess that's an interesting point, is that you do measure both trust and acceptance here. How do they differentiate?
Yeah, so in the work that we do, trust is a reflection of the strength of the relationship between, say, community and rural industries in this case. And acceptance is the product of that relationship, as well as other things that influence the level of acceptance that are outside of the control of rural industries themselves.
As you say, this has been an ongoing project. So over the past 4 years, has there been significant shifts in attitudes towards rural industries?
Yeah, I think there's been some really strong, important, consistent features and some changes as well. So consistently what we found is that the key driver of community trust in rural industries is environmental sustainability. Doing good work now to manage impacts, but then also with an eye on sustainability for the future, as well as procedural fairness, which is the idea that rural industries are listening to community concerns and taking action based on those concerns. That's been really consistent across time. What's changed over time is a couple of things as well that are really important. One is that over time, community respect for and value of rural industries started really high and has continued to grow, which is really important in the context of some other work that I've seen that shows that farmers often feel underappreciated by the Australian community. In fact, the Australian community really highly value what rural industries do. Just have some concerns about some parts of rural industries practice. And then one challenging thing that's changed across time is that we're seeing a decline in community connection to the land, which is really important in empathising with and aligning with rural industries. And also what we've seen is some decrease in the extent to which the Australian community feel connected to rural industries through the products that it creates, which we've also found to be a strong driver of trust. So improving those things is a real priority, I think, particularly amongst young people within the Australian community.
Yeah, because I think with that, particularly with that connection issue, it was more younger people that you found was declining in that connection?
Yeah, exactly. It's almost a linear relationship, which means that's a really uniform trend across age. The older you are in the sample that we collect, the more positive you are about rural industries, more connected you feel, the more the products help you to feel connected to the farmers themselves, reduce these great products. And the younger you are, the less positive you are in all of those aspects. And that's, for me, that's the big kind of concern in this data is how do we connect with young people? How do we form those connections that we did in the past?
As you say, one of the main driving influences in trust is environmental management. That is something that really stood out, is increasing. So the better that rural industries are managing the environment and be seen to be managing the environment equals a greater level of trust.
Yeah, exactly. So on issues like water management, you know, that's a key touch point for community. On a continent like ours, you know, understanding is really responsible use of water, and also confidence in the regulatory regime around that is really important for community trust. However, what we also see is that background kind of environmental conditions play a part in community attitudes as well. So as drought in many parts of the country eased, We also saw an easing of concern around water use in rural industry. So part of that is cyclical, and it's about using the better times to engage in the more difficult, challenging conversations on that platform of really strong community trust to progress those conversations rather than trying to do that when times are tough. I think that's really a key message in this research too.
I guess one of those trickier conversations that often comes out of rural industries is animal welfare as well. Where does that sort of sit as a factor and an influence?
Yeah, the extent to which farmers are seen to treat animals with dignity and respect is an important driver of trust. And so the more that people feel that way, the more trust they have in rural industries. And if you think about this research, we're looking at all rural industries, not just industries that involve animals. So this is a really strong effect that comes through quite consistently, particularly in the most recent data. And however, what we see in the data is community understanding quite clearly that animal welfare is not a simple issue, that in fact this is quite complex work. And I think that bodes well for more nuanced conversations rather than trying to just have these sort of bite-sized, super clean slogans or lines about animal welfare. I think Australians are up for the conversation about the challenges of managing animals within rural industries and the good practice that goes on, as well as the R&D that's happening to support improved animal welfare in the future. So, I think that's an important component here. There is really ripe opportunity for meaningful conversation, not just slogans in these spaces.
I'm speaking with Dr. Kieran Moffat. He is the lead researcher involved in this national survey we're talking about today that has gauged the level of community trust in rural industries. Interestingly, as part of this year's research, it looks like you also had some additional questions included around community sentiment towards large food retailers, which is a very timely conversation given a lot of the media coverage of late.
Yeah, it is. What really intrigued us is that after COVID, what we could see is that trust in a whole range of different groups increased dramatically. So trust in rural industries increased dramatically. Trust in the government at both state and federal level increased dramatically. And trust in large retailers increased dramatically. What we saw, though, is that about a year after, the real crisis period for COVID occurred, during which time, of course, going to the shops was only one of the four places you could go, and empty shelves were really on people's minds, and retailers did a great job of making sure that things were available. But as did rural industries, right? A real hero of COVID for Australia were rural industries keeping those supply chains open. What we could see in the data, though, is that while trust in government, trust in rural industries came back towards that pre-COVID average level, trust in retailers maintained for a good couple of years. What we've seen this year, though, is that trust in those large retailers has come back, and other work that we've done has shown that that trust in retailers is really based on competency rather than on humanity, as an element or a dimension of trust. So it's not like community members were thinking that retailers were, the good guys in this story. They were just really good at making sure that they were servicing customer needs. So I think, that really kind of reflects what we see in the larger conversation about retailers at the moment, which is that there's a real tension between consumers or customers of retailers and also producers that provide the goods on their shelves. So it's good to see that they're not sort of bulletproof in that conversation, because I think there's some important components to talk through there.
So what, at the end of the day, is the value of having all of this data and delving this deep into community sentiment towards rural industries? How can this help our rural industries, knowing all of this?
Yeah, look, I think there's some really simple things, and then I think some really important, more complex things. So some of those simple things are, as we discussed earlier, challenging assumptions around things like community attitudes towards rural industries. If a lot of farmers feel like they are taken for granted by and attacked by community members, and in fact they're not, we need to challenge that assumption to find common ground in how we work on those issues that are challenging, like chemical use or animal welfare or environmental sustainability. That's really, you know, fundamentally important in building a relationship on trust. And then more complex areas are in supporting rural industries to develop the skills to engage community effectively on the issues that matter to community, to build strong social license. So, for example, having meaningful conversations about animal welfare rather than trying to take a really defensive view or you know, really simplifying those issues, you know, that's really good, meaningful data to inform research development strategies for RDCs in rural industries, but also for farmers on the ground to understand that, you know, they are really well aligned in terms of the values they hold around protecting the environment and the views of Australians. So what we're doing is working with rural industries to turn this research into really practical extension work on the ground and also at strategic levels within industries and research development corporations.
Dr. Moffat, thank you very much for joining us on the Country Hour today. Great to chat to you.
You're very welcome, Selena, anytime.
As Dr. Kieran Moffat, lead researcher for the Community Trust and Rural Industries Project, and that work was carried out by AgriFutures Australia.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
It's going on 10 minutes to one. We have talked a bit about the high cost of olive oil at the moment, and it seems it's a tough time out there for growing olives globally. But this year's olive season is shaping up to be a very tough one for growers, and some in the industry are saying it may be our state's worst season ever. Rio Vista Olives General Manager Gerald Bettio says early frost is to blame for low fruit levels on trees.
There was a frost that hit most growers in the state, and because that's the time when the flowers are open, it obviously ruins the flower, freezes them that little bit, and so they don't tend to pollinate. If they pollinate it at all, they'll do what's called shot berries, which is tiny little fruit, but that's pretty well useless for making oil or table olives out of.
So how much will that impact the remainder of the season then? Could yields be pretty significantly down in South Australia potentially?
I would say yields this year would probably only be about 30% of what they were last year.
Wow, that's a big difference then.
Yeah, it's quite a dramatic downturn. The growers those that are running them as businesses, most of them weren't really affected. They had contingencies in place for frosts and did what they needed to do, and so most of them are going to crop pretty well as usual. But yeah, the vast majority of growers in SA are probably smaller producers, and they're the ones that seem to be the worst affected this year.
So has this happened recently in recent years, or is this the first time in a while that growers have had to face this?
Well, I think for Australia, considering that the industry is probably only about 25 years old here, I think this is probably the worst season we've had in Australian olive growing history.
Right. Are you hearing similar things interstate as well?
Yeah, a lot of groves in the East Coast, particularly in the Hunter Valley and throughout Victoria, have been hit pretty hard. Some have also had trouble with, I guess, insects. There's a particular insect called an olive lace bug. And once again, if you're not set up to do your spraying for those sort of pests, they can quickly get hold of your grove. But there's a lot of support there for the growers with the Australian Olive Association. They've got field guides, best practice scenarios. There's even a webinar which they have recorded on how to deal with those sort of pests. If the growers have been following that, most of them have come out unscathed. It's just the ones, I guess, that haven't had either the finances or the time to do the spraying they needed to at their grove. It's hit them pretty hard too.
Mm. So you would probably expect then that there will be shorter supply of olives and olive oil following the end of the season?
Definitely, but this isn't just an Australian phenomenon. Like, Spain's had this problem they've been having low yields for about the last 4 years, which means there's a fairly large shortage of olive oil around the globe. The quality of olive oil around the globe, though, has remained pretty high because a lot of the groves that have been affected weren't
particularly in Spain, weren't your high-end producers. So although olive oil prices have gone up around the globe, quality's pretty exceptional at the moment, actually.
So, yes, there have been, as you said, cases of international olive oil has jumped up quite a lot in price, but the same thing might happen in Australia for Australian-produced goods as well then.
Oh, for sure. Australian producers are getting approached by overseas buyers and being offered substantial amounts. In fact, if they were to sell overseas at the moment, they would make far more than selling in Australia because there is just huge demand globally.
And do you know of many growers deciding to do that?
There are some that are doing that, but I think most of us realise that it'd be a bit of a short-sighted thing to sort of abandon your Australian market to support an overseas market that's going to drop you as soon as their market returns to normal. So although all of us would get more money selling it elsewhere, we've tried to keep our prices down as much as possible. But the thing is, obviously, your costs on a bad year are the same as your costs on a good year in actually looking after your growth, except you've got far less quantity of fruit to cover your costs. So hence, that does drive prices up. Your expenses, unfortunately, don't go away because of a frost.
Jared Battillo there. He is the general manager of Rio Vista Olives, and he was speaking to Elsie Adamo. Well, finally today, the dirt in your backyard could be the key to helping scientists better understand the impacts man-made chemicals have on human health and the environment. Our study is underway on the impacts of century chemicals, and with the help of you, citizen scientists. The University of Adelaide School of Agriculture, Food and Wine is looking into highly resistant PFAS chemicals or century chemicals that exist in residential backyards across Adelaide. Dr. Matthias Salomon is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Adelaide.
The reason why we're interested in PFAS is because it is a group of man-made chemicals that's very stable and long-lived in the environment. And as such, it can also accumulate in the environment. And to date, there's no research out there whatsoever focusing on PFAS in people's gardening soil.
How has it sort of come about to look into PFAS in soils, and how is that sort of detrimental to maybe people's health or things like that?
There's some studies emerging that point towards a potential negative effect of PFAS on human health and also the wider ecosystem health. But at this stage, I also have to say that this is usually observed at very high concentrations. Then you might see some disruptions to the body's hormone function or potentially liver toxicity. But as I said, it's at very high concentrations, and to date, there's no reason to believe that such high concentrations could be found in gardening soil. However, at the same time, handling soil and potentially eating produce from your own home could be a potential pathway of getting PFAS into your body. But really, we don't know that for sure yet. So as I said, it is a research gap, and we kind of have to see what we find first.
So what's the process once you've collected the soil samples? What's the process from there in terms of testing it?
Yeah, so once we have the soil samples in our lab, as a first step, we're just going to dry it at a low temperature. And once it's dry, we homogenize it, so we need to make sure that there's no sort of bulking or any uneven patches within the sample. Once it's homogenized, we can then extract the PFAS, and we send it off to an external lab to get it analyzed.
So how can these, I guess, citizen scientists get involved with the study?
I guess the simplest way is to do an internet search for University of Adelaide and news, and that'll bring you to the university's news board. And as of today, the top news is our PFAS research. So just click on that and it will have all information you need to participate and just general further information that you might be interested in. So once the participants are selected, they will receive a soil sampling kit which contains everything you need to collect the soil samples and also includes a prepaid postage return satchel. And if people wish to, they can also have their individual PFAS results delivered via email with a bit of a explanation on where they sit compared to the average.
That is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Adelaide, Dr. Matthias Salomon there. He was speaking to Lily McCure. So hop on the University of Adelaide's website. If you go to the news section and just scroll through until you see the article about that soil study, and there's the links there if you would like to get involved, get your shovel out and send them a sample. It's not quite 2 minutes to one. Nikolai Bailharts will be with you this afternoon. Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Very, very well. Very well. This afternoon we're going to be taking a look at a roundtable that's being held with a whole bunch of different, parliamentarians, but South Australia Police, the Country Fire Service and the like when it comes to the road toll. And I think sometimes when you hear phrases like that, you think Talkfest. Mm-hmm. This, at least some of the attendees that are going to be heading along today are going to pains to say this is not a Talkfest. This is actually going to try and look at the ways to reduce the road toll, because it came down quite significantly in the early 2010s, but then it hasn't really since then. And of course, last year was a horrible year for road accidents. So they're going to be looking at three specific things, including vulnerable road users, so pedestrians and cyclists and the like, dangerous driver behaviour, but also the toll on regional roads, because of course that's so disproportionately high. So we'll take a look at that this afternoon and find out what can potentially be done. Is there still any low hanging fruit, for want of a better phrase, to be able to try and make things safer on the roads?
Yeah, what other levers could we be pulling?
Mm. Yeah, so I'll take a look at that. And also in our People of South Australia spot, which we have of a Thursday afternoon, Matt Gilbertson, aka Hans the German, will be with us as well. And I'm very keen to learn about whether the worlds of Matt Gilbertson and Hans, the persona, now overlap inherently.
Mm, where do the lines blur?
Or are they still separate things as such?
Fantastic. Sounds like a great program coming up with Nikolai. Stick around for that this afternoon. Thanks for your company today, and I'll be back tomorrow at noon for more Country Hour.
The ABC Listen app means you can take ABC Radio with you to the garden or around the country. Take a bit of home with you, wherever you go.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.